From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. The number of women with AIDS is growing. Many of them are single mothers. What will happen to the children? On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Laura Jimenez, who has AIDS and is the mother of a 10-year-old son. She'll tell us how she broke the news to her son and what it was like to make out her will and decide on a guardian. And we talk with Kara Levine, executive director of the Orphan Project, the organization she founded to research what happens to the children when a parent dies of AIDS. Also, we talk with Brian Lamb, the creator and CEO of C-SPAN. And TV critic David Bianculli previews tonight's telemovie, Marilyn and Bobby, Her Final Affair. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. President Clinton came to the Capitol today to round up votes for his deficit reduction package. The House is expected to take up the plan tomorrow, and the administration gave a concession today in hopes of easing its passage. NPR's Brian Naylor reports.
The president was flanked by four House Democrats this morning who voted against the original plan in May, but now say they will support the compromise. Still, the president is losing others who voted for the original plan but are now against what negotiators have worked out. One provision in the bill that's coming under attack from Republicans makes retroactive to last January 1st the higher taxes for upper-middle-income and wealthy Americans, Republican Congressman Dick Armey of Texas.
The very notion that the Democrats are raising taxes retroactively strikes terror in the hearts of millions of Americans.
Hoping to defuse that sort of attack, the administration said today it would give the 1.5 million taxpayers affected by the change more than 2 years to pay the retroactive taxes. This is Brian Naylor at the Capitol.
The Clinton administration increased its request for Midwestern flood relief by $1 billion today. In a letter that was read on the Senate floor, White House Budget Director Leon Panetta agreed to a request from Midwestern lawmakers to give farmers full coverage for their eligible crop losses. The additional money would bring the administration's request to $5.8 billion. Once it clears the Senate, the aid measure will have to be reconciled with a $3 billion measure passed by the House last week. Two Los Angeles police officers convicted of violating Rodney King's civil rights have been sentenced to 2.5 years in prison. Ina Jaffe has the story.
Prosecutors had asked Judge John Davies to impose stiff sentences on the defendants, 9 to 10 years for Stacy Kuhn and 7 to 9 years for Lawrence Powell. But the judge said that while the two men had been convicted of a violent offense, they posed little threat to society. He went through the videotape of the King beating moment by moment, saying that Rodney King had resisted arrest and that only the final half dozen blows violated King's civil rights. Therefore, said the judge, federal sentencing guidelines allowed him to downgrade the severity of the sentence to a range of 30 to 37 months. Prosecutors again argued for a lengthy jail term, saying that neither of the officers had shown any remorse for their actions. But Judge Davies cited Lawrence Powell's and Stacy Kuhn's history as upstanding members of the community and gave them the lowest possible sentence. I'm Ina Jaffe in Los Angeles.
Stock prices came to a mixed close today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 9 points to close at 3,552. The NASDAQ Composite Index gained 4.73 to close at 713.74. Advances edged declines in heavy trading of 220 million shares. This is NPR. Ethnic Serbian forces claim to have captured a strategic mountain overlooking Sarajevo. If it's true, the capture would give the Serbs a commanding position from which to fire artillery into the Bosnian capital city. It would also cut off what's said to be the last route for smuggling weapons to the Muslim-led government. IRS Commissioner Margaret Richardson says her agency will act immediately to make sure taxpayers' returns are kept confidential. Richardson was responding to disclosures that IRS employees snooped in the tax files of family members, acquaintances, and celebrities. NPR's Tui Vu reports.
The IRS discovered the improprieties during an internal probe of the Southeast Region Office based in Atlanta. Of the nearly 370 employees investigated, the IRS says four face possible criminal prosecution for creating fraudulent refunds. But most of the workers, the agency says, browsed files out of mere curiosity. Those workers have been disciplined. IRS Commissioner Margaret Richardson says her agency will put better controls in place, but she's not sure that will be enough to completely guard against abuses.
Because I don't think you can ever protect 100% against someone who has a fraudulent intent.
At today's hearing, senators said the public trust has been eroded. They urged the IRS to make the necessary changes to restore public confidence. I'm Thuy Vu in Washington.
Eight Democratic senators called on the Pentagon today to release an independent study that they say challenges the rationale behind the ban on homosexuals in the military. The $1.3 million study was commissioned by the Pentagon from the Rand Corporation. The senators say it found no substantive basis for maintaining the ban. They said it also cast serious doubt on the wisdom of adopting the so-called Don't Ask, Don't Tell, Don't Pursue policy announced by President Clinton. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. More women are becoming infected with the HIV virus. In fact, in New York City, AIDS is now the leading cause of death among women 15 to 44 years of age. Many women with AIDS are single mothers, facing not only the possibility of death, but the possibility of leaving children alone in the world. Later on the show, we'll hear from the founder of the AIDS group, The Orphan Project. Laura Jimenez is a single mother with AIDS. Two of her children are in their 20s and on their own, but her son Matt is 10, and she's been making arrangements for his care if she dies. Jimenez lives in a housing project in the Bronx. Health problems forced her to give up her job, but she's been working with the People with AIDS Coalition. She's one of the mothers with HIV profiled in a recent edition of Vogue magazine. Jimenez found out she had AIDS in late 1990, but she only recently told her 10-year-old son. I asked her why the time seemed right.
Well, I couldn't hide it. I've done so many things for AIDS, and I've been very active in the AIDS and the Vogue layout that he did with me. I don't know if you people read it, but he was in one of the pictures. And he started getting inquisitive, and I do a lot of things for AIDS, and he's around me, and I just waited for him to finish his test, and we went on vacation, and I chose that moment because I didn't want him to feel that, you know, that I was trying to pressure him into you know, hurting. You know, a lot of kids wonder, you know, what's going to happen to me and things like that.
What was his reaction when you told him?
He cried. The same reaction. Funny, it's the same reaction I had when I found out I was HIV positive. He told me he didn't want me to die, and he cried, and that was my same reaction. I cried, and I said I'm gonna die, and it was like a mirror, and it was very scary. And I assured him that mommy felt very healthy, and mommy was taking care of herself, and mommy had no intentions of dying. And if I did pass away, I had made arrangements for him to be with someone. And he cried a lot. He hugged me. It was a very sad situation. I found it very hard to do, to explain to a 10-year-old. And I asked him if he had any questions, and he said he would like to read the article because I kept the article away from him that was in the Vogue. And I gave him the Vogue, and I made him read it. And he came back and he asked me some more questions. And I tried to answer them as truthfully and as, you know, as I could.
What were some of the other questions that he asked you?
In my interview in Vogue, they explained that when I first found out I attempted suicide by unscrewing the window gates off my bedroom. And I sat there for 6 hours contemplating to jump. Because I didn't know what to do. And in the Vogue, it said this, and how I was contemplating divorce, and the only thing that stopped me, I told him, the only thing that stopped me was him, thinking about, you know, I was going to leave him without a mommy, and I didn't want to do that. You stopped me, Matt, worrying about you, wondering how are you going to feel, And he asked me to see the window. I showed him the window. And he asked me if I would do it again. And I told him no, that I go to therapy now. And I says, it's hard at times, but I says, I'm learning to deal with it.
One of the things your son wanted to know was what would happen to him if you died. What did you tell him?
I told him that I had made a will and that his aunt Chicky or his sister, older sister Lisa, were going to take care of him. And no matter what, that I would always love him. And it was the hardest thing to do, you know, in my life. Like I explained to the interviewer before, I've been through two divorces, and like it was amazing how easy it was. When you sit down and you write after, you know, a will, living will, and you sit down and you read it, and what you want to do with your child, you know, it's hard to accept. The day I went to pick it up, it just screwed me up totally emotionally. And I explained to him that he was going to be taken care of, that he had nothing to worry about. And he looked at me and he cried. He says, I don't want you to die. And I says, I don't want to die. And we cried together, and, you know, it's better now. It's better now. He's, my daughter and me, we have a relationship, you know, we've gotten very close, you know. And I went to Florida to tell my mother, and it was a very bad reaction, what I got from my mother.
What kind of bad?
She threw me out of her house.
Why?
She told me I was no damn good.
Because you had AIDS?
Yes. This is what I feel. I don't know. She was totally mad at me, and I don't know. I really, to this day, I haven't talked to her since I came back. I got back on the 28th. And I'm in, I feel like somebody's taken a shotgun and shot me again because, you know, dealing with the devastation of having HIV, and I hadn't told her. I kept it from her, but being that I'm going to do a segment on, you know, women in crisis in, for 60 minutes, it's going to be on air on TV, I wanted her to tell her before she seen it on TV, and I didn't want to hurt her in that sense. And I, you know, I wanted to sit down and let her know. And when it wound up to be very bitter and very harmful, and I told her in a very bad way, which I, you know, I forgive myself, but I was angry, and she didn't give me the chance to do it the right way.
But how did you tell her?
I, you know, my mother has had a heart attack, and she's had a pacemaker, and she's going blind with her diabetes. And we were in the argument, and I told her, you know, you should stop feeling sorry for yourself and get up and exercise and help yourself with the diabetes and stop eating so much. I says, you're not dying. I says, I'm dying. And I walked away from her, and I left it at that. And I says, you know, I says, I wanted this time to be special. And I see it couldn't, and it has hurt me. Like, I want to see my therapist because I feel like she didn't give me the chance to explain myself and what was happening. And the compassion that I needed from my mother, I didn't get. And now there's a hole in me, you know, where I tried to deal with every day, you know, just surviving and taking care of myself, not for my son, you know, but it's hard, you know. It's hard. Right now, I got a dispossess in the mail because I thought the Division of AIDS Services were going to pick up my rent, and I see they didn't pay my July rent. And, you know, these are things that affect me emotionally.
So what happens now?
Well, you got to go back to the Division of AIDS Services with the dispossess notice, and they have to pay it. But this is, you see, my rent goes directly to housing, and they overlooked it. And this is things, these little things stress one out. Like I got, when I opened up the mailbox and I seen from a lawyer, I opened it up and, you know, my stomach totally flipped on me, you know, and I have to call her back, and I'll have to go sit in this nasty office with seven kind of funguses growing and sit there and wait for them to decide to take care of me. It's totally humiliating as a human being. Not only have you have to deal with your sicknesses, it's in a disgusting neighborhood, totally drug-infested and drug addicts hanging on the corner selling methadone and drugs and whatnot. And when you go in there, I have to go bring my son to this. And I find it is deploring as a person, as a human being. You know, I worked. I've taken care of my children. You know, I've done what I'm supposed to do. And, you know, not only dealing with the HIV, I'm trying to bring myself up that, you know, if I can help another woman understand this, you know, because I figured it didn't touch me. I wasn't a drug addict and I wasn't gay. And I went into total shock when I found out.
My guest is Laura Jimenez. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. My guest, Laura Jimenez, is a single mother with AIDS. She has two grown children and a 10-year-old son. By the time she was diagnosed with AIDS, she'd been infected with HIV for 6 years. How did you find out you had AIDS?
I was being treated at Mount Sinai Hospital. I was going back for dysplasia. Dysplasia is something's wrong with my cervix. I was getting irregular periods, night sweats. And being that I didn't fit into the drugs, criteria. I don't look like a junkie. I never was a junkie. So that was the farthest thing from their mind, testing me for HIV. After I went through a series of tests and biopsies for cancer and everything else, everything came out negative. So one of the nurses suggested I would take the HIV test. So I figured everything else came out negative. I says, I'm not a junkie and I'm not gay, so I'm all right. So I took it. And when I found out my T-cells were 190, they went down to 170, and now they're 365, and due to the medication I'm on.
Do you know how you got it?
Sexually. Oh, I know who gave it to me. I found out who gave it to me.
Do you think he knew when he gave it to you?
When I met him and I confronted him and I kept on telling him, does he know what he did to my life? He swore to me. He says, Laura, not you. And we've seen each other for quite a long time. And I asked him, I says, were you a junkie or you were something that I don't know? Or you, what were you doing? Going, you know, around screwing everything in town? And I was so furious. And he kept on saying he was sorry. And he was sorry. And I hit him. I smacked him across his face. And this was in the clinic. The clinic I go to, Mount Sinai Hospital. And my girlfriend came out. And I was hysterical crying. I kept on yelling at him, you know what you've done to my life. And he kept on telling me he was sorry, that he didn't know. And my girlfriend put me in a room and she calmed me down and she told me, you know, she says, there's a possibility he didn't know just like you did. I says, why me, you know? And that I said it, but now when you put the pieces together, you know, when you have unsafe sex and you don't know what this person has done in their past, and I still don't know if he was going around having unprotected sex with a lot of women or he was a junkie. To me, that I know him for 5 years, he was never in that criteria of a junkie, you know, but, you know, like I say, you never know.
You've made plans that if something did happen to you, that either your son's aunt or his sister would take care of him. Was it really hard to bring it up with them?
Yes. Yes, it was very hard.
How did you do it? How did you bring up the subject?
I asked around. See, my daughter, she was in an unstable relationship, and she's my oldest. She's 24. And I sat down, I told her, I told my son. And my son's life wasn't too stable, so I want somebody that I know is going to take care of my 10-year-old. And my daughter is his second mother, and I sat down and I told her, the reason why I wasn't leaving Matt to her, because her life wasn't too stable, and she has nothing to show for it. And even though she had 1 year of college, she went back to school now, and she got her medical assistant's degree, and she just started a job in Lincoln Hospital. And I don't know if I motivated her, which I, you know, I hope I did, but she tells me she's not leaving her brother with nobody. I arranged to have Matthew with a person that is financially secure, drug-free, has a job. This is my older sister. My older sister never took drugs. And, you know, I'm looking for a place where he can stay with the family. You know, this, because I've seen a lot of children. I had two friends of mine. One died of asthma, and one died of HIV-related illness. One of them, she had three children. She left them to a grandmother. Her husband she was living with took the recently born, and they took the little girl and the boy to Florida. The girl was 13, 14 years old. A month later, she hung herself in the basement, and she said she left a note. She wanted to be with her mother. People don't realize the traumatic experience it is on a child. And I also seen my girlfriend died of asthma, and there's a fight over the children. And I feel the children that are dealing with the grief, and they have to worry about who's going to take care of me. I don't believe that these children should have to suffer.
Do you feel that your relationship with your son has changed since he found out that you have AIDS?
Yes. Yes. He's very close to me now. When I talk to him, I don't get that bad reaction. You know, like a little sassiness, I don't get that no more. When I scold him, he thinks about something. I let him know that, you know, I'm disappointed in him if he does something wrong. And it has affected it. There's no way it can affect a household. You see a person taking medication, there's times that I can't even get out of bed. You know, I'm tired, totally drained. And it hurts.
So how has your health been?
Well, when I found out, I went from 190, my T-cells, to 170. I went on AZT immediately. I was on Bactrim to prevent pneumonia. They give you all these medications. The AZT is very toxic. I was taking it. I had constant diarrhea, constant vomiting. I lost something like 75 pounds. I looked like I was on crack. A lot of people thought I went on a massive diet. A lot of people asked me if I was on crack. And I told them, yeah, and I walk away, you know, stupid people, because I didn't want to relate what was going on with me. The AZT is so toxic, they knocked it down to from 500 milligrams a day to 3, and it's still, I lost the, it's called monocophy, I think it's called. It deteriorates the muscles in your bones. I had to stop working. I worked for a full year until I found out I couldn't walk. I was losing my legs due to the medication. Now I'm on DDI because I complained a lot, and the AZT was helping me deteriorate faster. I'm on DDI. My T cells have gone up. I gained 30 pounds, which I've always been a heavy woman, but I feel a lot better this way, a lot stronger. My legs are, you could say, 90% back, and you know, and I just take care of myself.
Well, I want to, you know, wish you the best. I wish you good health. And I thank you very much for talking with us.
No problem.
Laura Jimenez spoke to us from her apartment in the Bronx. Kara Levine is concerned that the children orphaned by AIDS will become a lost generation. She co-authored a study which projected that by the turn of the century, between 80,000 and 125,000 children in the United States will have lost their mothers to AIDS. This will not only be a personal tragedy for each of those children, it will be a social crisis. Levine is the founder of the Orphan Project, devoted to studying and advocating policies and programs that meet the needs of children surviving a parent's death from AIDS. She's the former director of the Citizens Commission on AIDS. Levine says the orphans of AIDS are an especially vulnerable group.
I think many of them are very vulnerable, not just because they come from poor families, but because they live in communities where there's violence all the time, where there's the ravages of drugs, where there's chronic unemployment, where there's poor health care and poor health status. One study by Barbara Drayman of the Division of AIDS Services here in New York City found that, looking at teenagers, found that a large majority of the kids had experienced more than one significant loss, such as divorce, separation, incarceration of a parent in the previous year, so that the loss of a parent or the death of, or the illness of a parent with HIV is probably not the only thing that's going on in that child's life. And it's the accumulation of all of these traumas that I think really do present a unique problem that makes this problem different from the sad plight, but still somewhat more manageable, of a child, say, whose mother dies of cancer or whose parent is killed in an automobile accident. Those are tragedies nonetheless, but they are not in the same qualitative league as some of these, the stories of these youngsters.
There are a lot of teenagers who are being
left
without parents.
Yes.
Because of AIDS. Are they, do they have any unique problem?
Yes. I was surprised and then not surprised when I found, both from the epidemiological analysis and from all the conversations I've been having with service providers and families, what's happening is that a lot of the teenagers are becoming, in a sense, the caregivers for the younger children. They're becoming the caregivers for the sick parent. They're becoming adults before their time. And on the other hand, there are some who are almost totally without adult supervision, and they are beginning to act out their anger, their frustration, and their despair almost in many serious ways, in terms of getting in trouble with the law, in terms of teen pregnancies and so forth, and risky behavior that may, in fact, put them at risk for AIDS.
What do you think the social service system needs to do to respond to children who are orphaned from AIDS?
Well, I think one of the things it needs to do is to have special training for all the staff who work with these kids and families so that they're sensitive to the problems of stigma, to the problems of confidentiality, to the all of the issues that pervade these the kids' lives and the families' lives, so that they can do the best with what they have. There's really a desperate need for training. Then I think there's really a need for something specialized that will refer families to some of the services that are available. And there are, increasingly, there are some services, but they're not coordinated. There's not a whole system set up. My assistant has compiled a resource guide for New York City, and I was quite impressed with how many agencies are providing something. So often it's a question of getting people to know that there's something out there for them, getting them to feel comfortable in going for help if it's in bereavement counseling or whatever the issue might be. But we don't have any overall coordination. We don't have any overall plan. I think we do need at least some direction in that regard.
Kara Levine directs the Orphan Project in New York. She edited a book called A Death in the Family, Orphans of the HIV Epidemic, which will be published in the fall by the United Hospital Fund of New York. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. When it comes to broadcasting, C-SPAN goes against all the accepted rules. No sound bites, no editing, no commentary. They just let the cameras run uninterrupted, recording everything from proceedings in Congress to candidates on the campaign trail. Coming up, we meet C-SPAN's creator, CEO, and on-air host, Brian Lamb. And speaking of cable TV, our TV critic David Bianculli previews tonight's USA Network telemovie, Marilyn and Bobby, Her Final Affair. It mixes fact and fiction in telling the story of the alleged romance between Marilyn Monroe and Bobby Kennedy. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. On Capitol Hill, Senator Dennis DeConcini has announced that he will now support President Clinton's economic package. The Arizona Democrat originally voted no on the plan, and he pushed successfully for concessions for the elderly and assurances that tax money will go toward deficit reduction. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold reports.
Just a few hours after DeConcini met with President Clinton at the White House, he announced he was switching his vote from no to yes.
We need jobs, we need deficit reduction, and we need the end of political gridlock. And this is the best that can be put together.
DeConcini faces a tough re-election battle in Arizona next year. Even the Democratic primary is considered to be a toss-up. He demanded that a proposed increase in the amount of Social Security benefits retirees must pay taxes on be eased. And he asked for assurances that new taxes go directly toward deficit reduction. In exchange for his yes vote, the White House gave him what he wanted. DeConcini's vote now brings support in the Senate to a dead tie, which Vice President Al Gore can break, as he did earlier. I'm Elizabeth Arnold at the Capitol.
A federal judge in Los Angeles has sentenced two L.A. policemen convicted in the Rodney King beating to 2.5 years in prison. The two officers, Stacy Kuhn and Lawrence Powell, could have been sentenced to 10 years in prison and fined $250,000. They were charged with violating King's civil rights. The two men have been ordered to report to federal prison September 27th, and they are free until then, but not after, if they appeal. In Washington, a spokesman at the Justice Department said an appeal is being considered there. Under a 1987 law, both the prosecution and the defense may appeal sentences. In St. Louis, high waters are dropping slowly, but officials say danger from more than 50 floating propane tanks is still critical. Some 12,000 people forced out of their homes, but the tanks are still not sure when they will be able to go home. Andrea Murray of member station KWMU reports.
Tanks at the Phillips Propane Facility in South St. Louis have been bobbing dangerously in the river ever since it rose beyond 47 feet. It's feared stress to valves and pipes from the 30,000-gallon tanks could cause a leak of the highly explosive gas. Divers have isolated a bank of 5 tanks thought to pose the greatest risk. Phillips spokesman Rob Phillips said consultants and underwater video crews flown in last night will help decide if and when to burn off the remaining gas still leaking from the 5 tanks.
Nobody's been through this before with this number of tanks submerged under that much water for that long. So we just want to take the added precaution of making sure the consultants and the authorities are satisfied with our solution.
Officials say if they do conduct the 2 to 3 day burn-off, they'll let evacuees return home afterwards if they live more than a half mile from the tanks. For National Public Radio, I'm Andrea Murray in St. Louis.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down more than 9 points in heavy trading. This is NPR News. Secretary of State Warren Christopher says that he believes that Middle Eastern peace talks have been saved after recent violence in southern Lebanon, and talks will move ahead now. After meeting with Lebanese leaders under heavy security, Christopher said that Lebanon appeared to be ready to continue peace talks. Christopher also said that he wanted to emphasize just how hard the days ahead will be. The secretary worked out a ceasefire whereby both Israel and guerrilla groups in southern Lebanon agreed to stop their attacks. A study from Australia may help explain why babies who sleep on their stomachs are at greater risk of sudden infant death syndrome. NPR's Richard Harris reports.
The American Academy of Pediatrics says all babies should be put down to sleep on their sides or their backs to reduce the risk of sudden infant death syndrome, a mysterious ailment that strikes one baby out of every 1,000. But nobody understands why stomach sleeping increases the risk of SIDS. A study in this week's New England Journal of Medicine provides a hint about this mystery. It turns out that stomach sleeping isn't by itself that big a risk, but the risk of SIDS really goes up among stomach sleepers who have also had a recent illness or who sleep on a soft mattress or who are swaddled. Just how these factors conspire to increase the risk of sudden death, nobody can say. But the findings reinforce the recommendation to put babies down on their sides or their backs. This is Richard Harris in Washington.
A new survey finds that nearly 100,000 jobs were lost last month in the second largest monthly loss this year. The outplacement firm of Challenger, Gray & Christmas says that layoffs in the United States in the first 7 months of this year climbed to more than 353,600 workers. This compares to more than 201,000 last year at the same time. In trading today in Europe, the dollar was mixed. Gold prices moved down. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
Share. It's summer rerun time on the networks, but there's been plenty of new action on C-SPAN with its coverage of confirmation hearings and congressional debate on the budget, gays in the military, and military-based closings. C-SPAN has enabled us to watch our government at its best and its worst. It provides gavel-to-gavel coverage of House and Senate proceedings, hearings, debates, symposia on public policy, roundtable discussions, and call-in shows. C-SPAN is nonprofit, funded as a public service by America's cable companies. Brian Lamb is the founder and CEO of C-SPAN. But C-SPAN viewers know him as a host who does interviews and takes listener calls. I spoke to him last January. His mission is to bring events to us in their entirety, no editing, no commentary. He even wants the cameras to watch with a neutral eye.
We try very hard not to try to influence the audience with the way the camera angles are positioned or with the tightness of the shot. The best way to describe that, anybody that's ever watched 60 Minutes knows that they use special camera angles to help create a drama in the whole program. That's something that we would never do, at least we would knowingly never do it, because we want you to see the person or the individual exactly the way you would if you're sitting in a room with them. You wouldn't get up tight on their eyes or on their mouth. You would have a, you know, just a natural conversation. So if you go back to the conventions, you will, and you examined our coverage, there was a lot of effort made at not trying to artificially portray what was going on in the hall.
Let's talk a little bit about the creation of C-SPAN. You started proposing the idea of a cable network that would cover Congress back in 1977. Tell us how you got the initial idea for this.
Well, it was kind of an evolving thing. I came to Washington for the first time back in 1966 when I was in the United States Navy, and I was assigned to the Pentagon as a public affairs officer that literally every day dealt with requests from the commercial networks to cover different events. I mean, an example, at the time the Secretary of Defense was Robert McNamara, and if one of the networks wanted to interview him, they might call our department and I might get the call and I might have to, what they called it those days, staffing it. So I got very interesting exposure to how the whole system worked. And in 1966, I was 25 years old, and it was kind of my real, I mean, it's my first real education on how the system worked. The longer I was around it, the more I saw that a lot of what ended up on the evening news was not what happened that day.
Can you give me an example of something that you watched on the evening news and said, that's not what happened?
I'll give you a great example. There was a correspondent by the name of Bill Downs, who's no longer alive. He used to work at CBS. He was in the Eric Severide group years ago. And then he eventually was hired by ABC, and he was assigned to the Pentagon. When I was there in 1966, Bill Downs was the Pentagon correspondent for ABC. That was right in the middle of the Vietnam War and the buildup in 66 and 67. And I remember a group of young people coming down from Volantown, Connecticut, about 40 of them, marching against the war, coming to the Pentagon. They were going to disrupt the war machine, and they marched on the Pentagon, and they were allowed to come in, and they camped out in front of the war room where the Joint Chiefs of Staff met. And Bill Downs one afternoon, and I was assigned to be the, you know, the communications officer to go with him down to do his piece. And so he stood up in the middle of these young people. Up until that point, they had been lying on the floor. Very peaceful, very pleasant human beings. Had a strong message to deliver, and it was a pacifist message that the war was wrong. There's nothing wrong with any of that. That's part of our system. But the minute that the cameras rolled for ABC and that Bill Downs stood up, all of these young people stood up, took their placards, and started screaming, stop the war, stop the war. And so Bill Downs is shouting to the camera, you know, this is Bill Downs in the middle of all these young people outside the war room at the Pentagon for ABC News. There was nothing that the audience saw in that report that was an accurate account of how those young people had been operating. And that was one of many things that I saw when I was in the Pentagon that told me that there was just something a little bit askew here, and that the audience ought to see the whole thing and make up their own mind as to what is right and what is wrong.
So when you first started televising Congress, and this was back in 1979, what were some of the debates in-house and the debates with Congress about how to televise it? Where should the cameras be? Who should control the cameras?
Well, one of the most disappointing aspects of our association with the Congress, I think, over the years has been that they have had such tight control over the cameras. It's probably as tight a control as any country in the world. It doesn't track with what our democracy is all about, and I've never quite understood why they were so concerned about the coverage. But the Speaker of the House has total control over who will be televised and you know, basically photographed at any one point. And there have been some controversies over that. As a matter of fact, Tip O'Neill years ago turned the cameras on the whole chamber to show during special orders that there wasn't anybody there. You know, if I had anything to say about it, and I do not, and I've never tried to have anything to say about it, I would, you know, we would put our own cameras in there and we would show the chambers reflecting exactly what's there during the time of day when they're actually having legislative debate. So we really stay away from the operation of the House and its television facility. That's their business. We try to tell the audience often enough so that they know that they're controlling the cameras, so they don't think that we're doing it. That will probably not change for a long time.
Why not? Don't you have enough clout now to say, listen, you guys, you really want to be on C-SPAN now. You've seen the effects it has. So now we're going to insist that we control the cameras.
We don't have enough clout, don't have any clout with them when it comes to that. And as a matter of fact, the only people that have clout, and this is probably the way it ought to be, is the people. And if the public at large gets mad enough about anything that they see in the Congress, they can have a major impact. And probably the most recent example of that was the Zoe Baird nomination.
What would you do differently if you were controlling how Congress was televised?
Well, if we were allowed to put our own cameras in there, we would just show the facility as it is. We would show reaction shots. The only people that are allowed to be shown on camera are those speaking. You know, in the British House of Commons, they think they have the toughest laws in the world about what can be seen. But one of the laws, one of the regulations in the British House of Commons is that they can show reaction shots. If somebody is addressing another member of the parliament, the camera can pick that other member up to see what kind of face they're making. You can't even do that in the House of Representatives. And what I think they ought to do, both in the House and the Senate, and again, they don't ask me, and they're not about to ask me, but if they ever did, is that they ought to show it as it is.
My guest is Brian Lamb, the founder of C-SPAN. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. Brian Lamb, the founder of C-SPAN, is my guest. Now, did it take a longer time to convince the Senate? You didn't start broadcasting the Senate until 1986. Was that because of money or because they weren't interested?
Well, we didn't convince the Senate. The Senate convinced itself. And the way that worked was in 1981, when Howard Baker was majority leader, he put a piece of legislation into the hopper. It was, I believe it was Senate Resolution 20, if I can remember right, that would have opened the Senate to television. And for a lot of reasons, he was not successful during his tenure as majority leader in getting the Senate to go on television. Some people suspected that he was running for president and that that was his way of getting attention, through the cameras. But really what happened in the end was Senator Russell Long was one of the great opponents of televising the Senate, and so was Senator Robert Byrd. And back in about 1985 or so, Senator Byrd started to, and this is what he told me, he started to hear when he would go back home to West Virginia that people were confusing him with Speaker Tip O'Neill because they both had white hair. And they saw Tip O'Neill on television a lot. And I think what really did it for Senator Byrd was the day he got introduced as this, the Speaker of the House, Bob Byrd, at some function. At least that's what he told me. And he decided that if the Senate was going to be the institution that he thought it was, and that it was the world's most deliberative body and the world's most important debating organization, that the Senate better go on television. He convinced Senator Russell Long to step aside. He led the charge in the Senate, and when he did that and dropped his opposition, it was passed.
Brian Lim, you're the founder of C-SPAN and the CEO. How did you decide to put yourself on the air? You're one of the people who we often see on the air doing interviews or taking phone calls, doing continuity between broadcasts.
I was cheap. I was real cheap. Still am cheap. In the early days, there were only, when I went on the air first, I think there were seven people that worked at C-SPAN. I mean, we'd take a couple cameras up to the Hill and cover a hearing in the daytime, run them back to the studio. Actually, it was one big office where I sat in and one of my helpers, Janet Dabrowski, sat in. We all sat in one room. We cleared the desks off at 5 o'clock in the afternoon. We fired up the cameras. We opened them up and took calls. Telephone calls in 1980, October 7th was our first day, from the audience on our business lines. So sometimes we get a call from somebody that wanted to do business with us during the middle of a call-in show, and they found themselves on the air talking to us about issues. So in those very early days, and frankly, the only people that were paying attention, because no one in Washington could see us in those early days, were just common, ordinary, down-to-earth folks out there that knew everything that was going on, loved the fact that they were there in the early days, and didn't have any pretense or worry about whether or not we were sophisticated.
So, okay, so you put yourself on the air because you were cheap, you said. But I think your policy is basically not to hire on-air people, but to use people from behind the scenes.
We have about seven people now that go on the air.
Mm-hmm.
All but two of them work full-time at C-SPAN. Two of them do part-time work for us, fill in when we have problems. Everybody else has a major job. Susan Swain, who's on the air, is our senior vice president and co-chief operating officer. Bruce Collins is our general counsel. Luke Ketchum and Steve Scully are producers. And I'm sure I'm leaving somebody out. Jim Gately and Ed Maddox are outsiders who come in and do these shows for us on an ad hoc basis. The philosophy is that we are not a personality-driven network, that somebody has to sit there and punch the buttons. As a matter of fact, we've toyed with the idea of putting two guests out there and letting them punch their own buttons and see what happens. It'd be a little bit difficult if you hadn't done it before, only because it's kind of intimidating with all the technology. But the objective is just to stay out of the way, that let people talk to the guests, let them hear what the guests have to say. It's not unlike what you do, except that on television, as you know, almost everything that is done has to be personality-driven in order to keep those ratings high. Again, we have no requirement to have high ratings. And so we also want to make sure that our hosts, under no circumstances at any time, although this is very difficult to do, do not portray any kind of bias and just stay out of the way so that the public can make up their own mind about the guests and the callers can talk directly and form their own opinions. And, by the way, sometimes we come off as extraordinarily dull. Understandably so, we know that, but again, that's part of our thing. that...
That's right. No, but it's true. Listen, people... when people use the word dull in relation to C-SPAN, it's with some amount of praise, you know?
Well, it's... Yeah, and you do get tired of... You know, they dare to be dull, but it's an occupational hazard sometimes. Again, though, everybody needs to constantly look at who's paying the bills. And in our case, our industry is paying the bills through the good graces of our cable industry subscribers. They're not requiring us to deliver them eyeballs for advertisers, and that gives us an enormous amount of freedom. And because of that, we can be what we are, and we're not Pollyannas about this.
So I know one of the places you got your start on TV was doing a show called Dance Date, and this was, I think, when you were in college?
It was, and as a matter of fact, just to complete probably a childhood dream of mine, I met Dick Clark 2 weeks ago. The disgusting thing is he looks about 10 years younger than I do. And when I was growing up, I'm 51, when I was growing up, Dick Clark at WFIL in Philadelphia was the most important person in my life. I copied everything he did. I started my own little dance show in Lafayette, Indiana on Channel 18. I built the set, sold the time, hosted the program. And it was really one of the great learning experiences there's not a whole lot of difference between what I do today and what I did then. It's just a different topic of discussion.
Yeah, but it's very subjective to rate records, isn't it?
Yeah. What do you give this? A 95. I like the beat, you know?
Did you do that? Did you do those rate the record
things?
We did. Like Dick Clark?
As I said, Terry, I copied everything that Dick Clark, I think I even tried to sound like him, which is impossible. everything that he did, I tried to do.
So you played rock and roll?
Everything, yeah. Rock and roll. Remember, we had one camera to do this show. It was a black and white. Gary Henderson, one of the engineers here at NPR, is looking because he knows what I'm talking about, a Vidicon camera, which meant that it wasn't very good. And the way that we had, the way that we were able to do this show was that we photographed on film a record running, on a turntable, and we made a continuous loop so that the director could push the button, and on the screen would come this record. You couldn't see what record it was running around on your screen so that they could move the camera back to show some of the kids dancing in a different position in the studio. So it was as basic an operation as you could ever imagine. So, and that's kind of the way C-SPAN was, I can tell you, in 1979.
Brian Lamb is the founder and CEO of C-SPAN. Our interview was recorded last January. This is Fresh Air. Last night, the president asked for the public's support in helping him get the budget passed. Linda Wertheimer's with us. Linda, what will you have on the budget on All Things Considered?
We called some folks around the country to see what they thought about what the president said and about the budget compromise, Terry. We'll have them, and we'll also have Elizabeth Arnold, who will give us a true-false quiz about what this budget compromise does and does not do. Bob Garfield, by the way, tried to crash the most exclusive bowling alley in America, the very one at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue. We'll have a piece on that. The new owners of the Orioles, the Black Caucus, and there's a sentencing hearing today for the cops in Los Angeles, Tracy Coons and Lawrence Powell.
Thanks, Linda. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Tonight, the USA Network broadcasts a new telemovie that takes two famous figures from the past, Robert Kennedy and Marilyn Monroe, and links them romantically in a mixture of fact and fiction with the emphasis on fiction. Its producers call it a presentation of possibilities. TV critic David Bianculli calls it something else.
So much has been written about the Kennedys, including that controversial, inventive Ted Kennedy biography by Joe McGinnis, you'd think it'd be hard to scrape the bottom of that particular barrel. But Marilyn and Bobby, her final affair, doesn't just hit bottom. It sinks so low, it digs a new bottomless pit of tackiness for the USA Network. And if you've seen a few of that network's other telemovies, you know what a nasty insult that really is. Marilyn and Bobby stars Melody Anderson, who starred in Flash Gordon, as Marilyn. The former Attorney General is played by James F. Kelly, who's best known, I guess, for playing Bobby Kennedy in other telemovies. And here's the way screenwriter Gerard McDonald invents dialogue between them, as the two get to know one another at a private party.
My drama coach called me up. He wanted me to play Mrs. Alving. You know the play, Ghosts?
No.
Well, Mrs. Alving is crazy. And I said, what do you think? You think I want to get inside the mind of a crazy woman? No.
How, as an actor, can you get inside someone's mind? I mean, how could I get inside your mind?
You wouldn't like it if you did. It's a jungle up there.
It gets worse. Perhaps the most outrageously ridiculous scene, given the high profiles of both Marilyn Monroe and Bobby Kennedy, is the one where she picks him up curbside for an impromptu picnic. Instead of sneaking around, she tools up in a flashy convertible, he hops in like that action TV hero from The Big Chill, and this is what they say, loud enough for everyone to hear.
I'm all yours. Let's go, Monroe.
Oh, yes, sir, Mr. Attorney General.
Calling him Attorney General is hardly the height of discretion. But what's the point of complaining that certain actions don't seem credible when the whole movie is without credibility? Except for a scene where Marilyn sings Happy Birthday to John F. Kennedy at Madison Square Garden, a scene that uses actual news footage of the real JFK, by the way, there's almost nothing factual in this film. Not the hitman allegedly hired by Jimmy Hoffa to kill Bobby, or the scene where J. Edgar Hoover wakes up in bed with another man, or the scene at Marilyn's deathbed, where enough people run in and out of the place to make it look like a stateroom scene from a Marx Brothers movie. All of the real people portrayed as characters in this drama are dead, so they can't sue. But viewers should think about taking out a class action suit, because this kind of irresponsible filmmaking is one step away from criminal. This isn't docudrama, it's schlockudrama.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Daily News. Fresh Air's senior producer this week is Fred Landahl. Our engineers are Ojiva Blytus, Richard Parker, Chris Fraley, and Ron Barron. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Our show was directed today by Sue Spolin. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, the first African to be awarded the Nobel Prize for Literature. Wole Soyinka also writes about the politics of his country, or what he describes as Nigeria's tragic soap opera. He's now in the United States, warning that the future of democracy in Nigeria is in jeopardy. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.